Welcome back to the Bonfire Podcast, where we talk about the UFC and mixed martial arts with those closest to the fight game. I am your host, longtime MMA reporter and MMA junkie senior reporter, Mike Bon. Hope everyone out there is doing well. I'm still feeling a little bit of the hangover from UFC 322. Those New York trips are crazy, man. It's the fights end like 1:30, the press conference ends about 3:30, and then as I get older, I continue to question my choices to take the first flight out. I think my flight was at 6:15, so it was literally like leave the arena at 4, grab my bag, go straight to the airport. I got home at like 8:30 in the morning, so it's nice to be back that early after a fight, especially when you're traveling for it, but barely slept all of Sunday, and of course that gets you a little bit the day after, but not feeling too bad now. Great episode ahead, a lot of UFC 322 reaction, a lot of talk on the state of the welterweight division. Joining me to do so will be UFC analyst, UFC welterweight, a man who has spent much time in this division, Michael Chiesa. He's going to be breaking it all down. And we have a fun little game here of ratings for all the potential next contenders for Islam Makhachev, who made history in the main event, defeating Jack Della Maddalena, ties Anderson Silva's winning streak, 16 in a row, the longest in UFC history, becomes the 11th fighter to win championship belts in two weight classes. This man is special, barely had a scratch on his face after five rounds. I know some people hated on the performance. We'll talk all about that and rank each potential matchup and how significant, how likely it will be for Islam Makhachev next. A lot to go over, a lot of names to discuss, and then a little bit of UFC Qatar talk. Two massive fights on Saturday's card at the top. Of course, headline Armin Sarukian versus Dan Hooker, and then Bilal Muhammad versus Ian Machado Gary. Had a great chat with Bilal that's over on the MMA Junkie YouTube channel. I encourage you all to check that out. We'll be reacting a little bit to that as well. So a lot to go over. This is a bit of a lengthier episode, but honestly, I thought it was all very meaningful, great, insightful stuff from Mike Mav, who is going to be a favorite here and I think has a very, very, very bright future as a UFC analyst and commentator. His time is coming, no doubt. So I'm going to take a quick break and we'll be right back with the Tough 15 winner, the UFC veteran, Michael Chiesa. Back here on the Bonfire Podcast with another Mike and Mike episode. Mike Chiesa, how are we doing, man?
Doing good, my brother. It's good to be talking to you. What a great weekend of fights, man. Yeah, I'm excited to talk to you about it. There's so much going on in my division and a lot of changes, not only in the rankings, but I feel like in just kind of the what has kind of been the legacy and representation of the welterweight division has been primarily wrestlers. And now I'm seeing this paradigm shift into strikers, even though the champions at the top is a wrestler. So there's a lot to unpack and I'm excited to do it with you.
Yeah, we're going to unpack a lot here and definitely look forward and see how this is going to all shake out, because there's multiple guys who feel like they're title worthy right now that you could make a strong case for in another situation. They're the layup for a title shot, but it's not the case right now. And of course, this weekend at UFC Qatar, Ian Gary and Bilal Muhammad will have their say as well. But before we get into kind of pushing forward, let's look back a little bit. Of course, you know, amazing performance by Islam Makhachev against Jack Della Maddalena. How did that fight go relative to how you broke it down and your expectations?
It was one of those situations where I was very correct. And I say that with all due respect to Jack. Jack's got an incredible set of skills, but it just doesn't matter where your strengths lie or where your weaknesses are. When you're fighting a guy like Islam Makhachev, he's shown that he can do it all. He did it against Dustin Poirier, showcased his boxing, was forced into some exchanges because Dustin was able to defend takedowns. So a lot of the questions going into this main event against JDM was like, how is he going to fare with the size advantage, disadvantage? How is this whole thing going to play out? Yeah, Jack may have looked a little bit bigger, but it was, it was one-way traffic for Islam. And I think a lot of that kind of revolved around A, his skills, and B, with Jack Della, his stance opens up so much real estate for a grappler to get to his legs, specifically that snatch single. I mean, Islam, right off the get-go, that was the first takedown he got, quick little level change, picked that leg. And that's because JDM holds his hands so high. So once he got that first takedown, he just realized he could turn that snowball into an avalanche. And that's exactly what it was. And he captured the welterweight title and made it look relatively easy. I don't know. You know, I was talking to a few of the producers today and we were wondering, like, was there something going on with Jack Della? Because he seemed to be grimacing a lot on the ground. Was there an injury? I don't think Jack Della is the type of guy that's going to come out and say, well, I had this injury and this is why this happened. I think he'll probably play his cards close to his chest because that's just the type of fighter he is. But nonetheless, it doesn't take away from the dominant win that Islam Makhachev had on Saturday.
Yeah, and even if he does say something, it'll be like a two-word explanation because that's how Jack rolls. So, I mean, when I'm seeing people break down and, you know, it's hindsight, we don't actually know. And as the time we're recording, we haven't heard from Jack. His team put out a statement, but it was pretty generic stuff. But those two leg kicks Islam landed in the first 10 seconds of round one, the second one in particular, seemed to kind of, you know, bend Jack's leg a little bit. We don't know, but do you think those may have done some early significant damage to Jack?
Yeah, I mean, we've seen what those low calf kicks can do, man. It doesn't take much to cause damage. There's some fights where you'll see a guy have the ability to absorb a lot of them, and then you'll have a fight like we saw on Saturday where it was the second one seemed to have compromised Jack. So, you know, and for Islam, this is a guy who's technically proficient everywhere. There's a lot of attention to detail within that camp. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it was a perfectly placed kick. Perfectly executed game plan. I mean, it couldn't have gone any better for Islam, except for if he was to get a submission. But if you know Jack Del, I mean, and I think Bisping said something of this, or one of the commentators, like JDM could have taken the easy way out. If he was getting dominated on the ground, he could have just bellied over, you know, clocked out and called it a night. But he, whatever was going on, whether it was just a tough fight, a pre-existing injury, an injury from the leg kick, obviously he was having a tough night at the office, and he went all 25 minutes. So I think that's a big testament to the toughness and the heart of Jack Della Maddalena.
What was he doing defensively to get himself to the end of that fight? Like, Islam wasn't able to open up significantly with big damaging ground and pound. He had a couple, you know, early submission attempts, but I don't think the official stats actually credit him with a full submission attempt at all in that fight. Like, was Jack just, you know, minding his P's and Q's defensively, or why wasn't Islam able to do more on the ground?
I think just controlling posture, you know, to land good, significant ground and pound, you need space. And Jack Della did a good job, you know, controlling the head, controlling the posture, kind of tying up at least one of Islam's arms with either like trying to run an underhook, clamp down a wizard, but essentially kept his shoulder blades flat, which doesn't give him, you know, if you want to escape off bottom, you need to get on one shoulder, one hip, you know, and you're going to need that for sweeps. You're going to need that to get underneath your opponent, to become their base, to off balance them. And Jack really wasn't able to do much of that. So it was just a lot of controlling of Islam's posture and at least trying to tie up one of his arms to just keep him from being able to posture up and land that damage. And, you know, I'm just curious if with JDM, obviously, I think that there's a big emphasis on takedown defense. You have to emphasize takedown defense if you're fighting a guy like Islam. But I just wonder if, like, was there a big emphasis on trying to use jiu-jitsu? And honestly, when you're going against a guy like Islam Makhachev, if part of your grappling defense really revolves around, like, I'm going to use jiu-jitsu to get up off of bottom, I mean, that's going to be really hard. You need to be stubborn, like using wrestle ups. If you can't defend the takedown, wrestle your way back to your feet, wrestle your way back up into a dogfight position to get it back to standing. It's going to be so hard to rely on sweeps and things of that sort with a guy with such a heavy base like Islam.
So do you think, like, the whole Craig Jones thing, right? They make so much of it coming into the fights. And I know, like, Islam kind of took the little shot at him afterwards, which was funny. But, yeah, is that, like, maybe the wrong approach in terms of what you're saying? And not to say you kick him out of the camp or anything, but
no,
you need to do more and you can't rely 100% on his teachings.
You know, I think Craig has a lot of good insight. You know, and he, you know, Volkanovski gives him a lot of praise and helped him a lot, especially in that first Islam fight. But what Volkanovski did differently than what Jack did is in that fight, a lot of times Volkanovski was able to maintain motion if he got taken down. That's what led him being able to heist his hips and get back to his feet. If you get taken down against a guy like Islam and you start settling into a position like, I'm going to settle into a half guard, get, you know, flatten myself out essentially, and then now try to work from there, you're just going to get pinned. And so that's what Volkanovski did very well, was maintain motion through that first fight against Islam to get the fight back to the feet, to create scrambles, to create transitions, to give himself an opportunity to get to where his strengths lie, which is the striking. And JDM just wasn't able to do that. I think Craig's a great coach. I think he's a phenomenal tactician, a great follow on social media if you love controversy. No reason to kick him out of the camp. I just don't know if there's just a lot of questions on how compromised was Jack. It just didn't really seem, either Islam was just that good that he was able to shut him down like that, but he didn't really seem like the best version of himself. But I am convinced that even if a 100% injury-free Jack Della goes into that fight, I'm still not convinced that he wins. And I say that respectfully, but it's just, when you just saw the way Islam was able to execute his game plan, it's just hard for me to think that JDM wins that fight. Styles make fights, and that's stylistically, that's a favorable matchup for Islam.
Yeah, I picked him coming in as well. I thought it might look kind of like that. Maybe he would get the finish earlier at some point along the way. But do you think as we talk about him not being able to get off those submissions and that ground and pound, does that have anything to do with Jack? Like, did you see a difference on maybe the chances he took Islam on the ground and what he was able to do? Like, maybe Jack's just stronger, so he can't get the space he needs, things like that.
That could very well be it. I mean, Jack Della, while they're not far off in height, if you've ever seen Jack Della in person, the guy, he's got very, very wide shoulders. He's a wide body. He's got long limbs, you know, and you can see when he fills in, you know, when he fills out after weigh-ins, he's a big guy. You can tell he's definitely strong, especially even in just the way he punches. He doesn't wind up on a lot of his strikes, but there's enough power there that he doesn't have to, and he can shut your lights off. So I do think that the strength and the physical attributes of Jack Della Maddalena helped keep him in that fight, helped him be able to thwart off the submission attempts from Islam Makhachev. I mean, I had Islam picked to win, but I did not think he would get the finish. I think Jack Della is just way too tough. He's too durable. He's too resilient. I thought he might win a round or two along the way, but I in the end, I thought it'd be Islam winning a decision.
Did you think, you know, like the criticism Islam's getting, it's kind of similar to what Khamzat was getting after the fight, just, you know, like maybe too much ground control with not enough damage or pursuit of finishing the fight. Is any of that fair? Like, as you said, off the beginning, he's kind of in the mold of this welterweight division. And I was going back and looking through GSP's fights and like stats wise, like against Dan Hardy, he had 20 plus minutes of control time, like one submission attempt. There was more ground and pound attempts, but like, there's 4, 5, 6 GSP fights where he had 15 minutes to 20 minutes of control time and did not get a finish.
Well, I mean, for George is just a phenomenal tactician. You mm-hmm. know, everything's about the game plan and executing the game plan. You look at, he's got, George had some of the most brilliant minds in the sport in like every facet, like MMA, yeah. Firas Zahabi, grappling, John Donaher, crew Phil Nurse, Muay Thai, like, you know, every guy just was so specific and one of the best coaches for the specificities of MMA, specialists, I should say. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, when you look at Islam's corner, you got Khabib Nurmagomedov, who's, you know, look who his father was, a phenomenal yeah. coach. And then obviously you have Javier Mendez. So great coaches as well. But when you talk about like the control time with like Chimaev versus DDP, Islam versus JDM, you know, if there's a path of least resistance, you take it, especially in these big fights. There's no need. Yeah, could you make the fight more exciting if you were to keep it on the feet and almost play against your strengths and still find a way to win? Chimaev has the striking to where he could have done that to DDP. He could have kept it on the feet and had a lot of success and still won that fight, but maybe sustained some damage along the way. For Islam, why in the world would you ever want to not play to your strengths against a power puncher like Jack Della? You get out there, you get the takedown as fast as possible, you control him, and don't give him room to breathe. That's just how you got to fight a guy like JDM, and that's exactly what Islam did. So, you know, while there may not well, they're not the most exciting performances from those two guys we just talked about, those two champions, you have to appreciate dominance. Mm-hmm. You have to appreciate a fighter if they can go out there and absolutely dominate the best fighters in the world, even if it's not the most exciting thing, even if it's not these barn burners that we want to see, the thing that the fans crave, you have to have an appreciation for dominance.
And I totally do. I think what he did was incredible, but I know, you know, some of the fans out there, they don't feel the same. They're so spoiled on a night like this, and it ends yeah. kind of with two slow title fights. So, like, I get it. We know it's an entertainment business, but for people like us, we obviously appreciate how incredible this guy is. It's like, and like you said there, everything at stake. You lose this fight, everyone is, you know, crapping on you. You have no belts. Ilya has already been saying, like, I'm not fighting this guy coming off a loss. So yeah. there's too much to deviate from that path of success for him. So I don't blame him one bit, but it sucks that, you know, Dana comes to the press conference and is like, oh, you know, wasn't the greatest fight. You want it to all be glowing, yeah. but this is the sport sometimes. So you got to yeah. go out there and win first. Absolutely. And for him, that's all he's done is win 16 freaking fights in a row, Michael. I didn't know if we'd ever see the day Anderson Silva's record would be tied. Like that, yeah. That thing ended in October of 2012. Here we are in 2025.
Yeah, that's just crazy. And all signs point ahead to that record being broken. I mean, there's a lot of, and obviously we're going to get into that here shortly, yeah. but like there's a lot of big threats for Islam, but would we really be that surprised if he broke Anderson's record? Given he's got so much, there's so many options for him in terms of what's next and a lot of skilled guys, people that could dethrone him on any given day. But would you really be surprised if he broke Anderson's record?
No. Well, no. One more feels very attainable, especially yeah. depending on who it is. I mean, I'm already dreaming of 20. Like, is that within reach? You know, can this happen? So I didn't yeah. know if we'd ever see that day. Just because, again, yeah. as I said to Dana White at the press conference, like you can get poked in the eye like Tom Aspinall and it turns into a no contest. You can screw up like John Jones and you get disqualified, let alone showing up, not feeling good, getting injured, the millions of things that can happen to you guys in there. So like, it's very hard to have that many consecutive with just no weirdness even coming into play either.
You know, yeah. And that was a great question, Mike Bond. I got to say, I did notice that at the press conference. I watched the presser last night and I'm thinking that's a really, really good question. And it makes such a good point because MMA, and maybe I have a bias when I say this, but when it comes to sports in the games and the competition, there's no more uncontrollable, you know, environment than a fight. So many unexpected things can happen, whether it's the biggest upsets, the craziest strikes or things we've never seen from a technique standpoint, or things like fouls. Just there's so many variables in a fight that can affect this type of situation. 16 fights in a row without a foul, without controversy. There's no fight you can go back on the 16 fight win streak and be like, ho hum, like it was a bad decision. It was bad judging. It was bad officiating. There was nothing. It's been a flawless 16 fights for Islam Makhachev.
Yeah. And for anyone, you know, if you want to be critical of this fight, sure, go look at the track record. Like, I think he's finished 12 of the 16 in this run. So it's not like we're getting this every single time out of him. As we said earlier, all the stakes are there. So you got to do it. You got to do it. Like you say, anything can happen. Half your team can get into a brawl in the arena half, like a few hours before your damn fight. Like, surprise, that doesn't throw you off mentally. That was crazy, too. That happened right in front of me, dude. Like, everyone there, I was the one who had like the closest footage there. Dylan getting dragged off. Dylan Danis, obviously, we're talking about. That was nuts. What were you thinking when all that was unfolding and like the footage was pouring in on social media?
You know, just the lore and fascination of John Pork just continues to grow is what I got to say. Listen, that's what you're going to get. And we shouldn't even be talking about Dylan Danis on this show. Let's be honest. Like, we're about to talk about like the best welterweight in the world right now and all these contenders coming up and John Pork, you know, probably one of my favorite unranked guys. Yeah. I shouldn't be calling him that because I know he doesn't like it, but it's just, it's too funny. It's a great story. But that's what happens when you stick a guy like Dylan Danis in a crowd. They're trying to keep, and Dana acknowledged this, how he's like, listen, that was my mistake. Jorge Masvidal, who has to get escorted around every event with two guys. That's not because he needs protection. That's because the UFC is protecting everybody else from Jorge Masvidal, you know? So he says that he's got a problem with somebody. It's not going to be a verbal exchange. So they're trying to keep Masvidal from Dylan Danis, and it just so happens that the contingency of Makhachev's team is right in front of Dylan Danis. And what's Dylan Danis going to do? He's going to piss gas on the fire. So that's exactly what he did, and he paid the price. So safe to say, I don't think we will ever see him at a UFC event again.
Yeah, for sure. And I see, just because I want to address this, because I'm seeing people, you know, getting mad on Twitter and stuff about how there's seemingly, from what Dana said, no repercussions for the Team Khabib people. We don't know this, but like, I did my best out there, guys. I asked Dana twice, like, about that side of it, if there was going to be any repercussions. If there was going to be, just like he said, Dylan is banned for life, he could have come out and he would have volunteered that information if he wanted to get it out there. I asked him twice. So what more do you want to do? They're going to make their decisions and is what it is. Like, we move forward. So
yeah, but also he also made sure to mention, like, that doesn't mean the MSG or any of anybody else involved in this event, you know, they might want to pursue legal action. But Dana said it best. Fighters are freaking crazy. Maybe if like Dylan Danis got really messed up, like maybe if like, you know, he left on a stretcher or something like that, or like really took some severe.
It's that guy who picked the chair up that the security guard grabbed it out of his hand, hit it with it like that. I didn't see that when it was happening. I was like, oh my God, if that went off, we might be having different conversations.
Oh, 1000%. It doesn't matter who you are. If you are on the UFC roster or not, if you hit somebody with a chair, like everybody is, you're going to get absolutely hammered with legal troubles, you know? So good on the security to jump in and handle that, because that could have made the situation totally different. It's kind of funny. You know, it's like, ha, like John Pork and the team and all these guys, like Dylan Danis got punked, whatever. It's funny to talk about now. Right. Had he got hit with the chair, there would be no humor in this at all. This would be a very different conversation.
No, facts. I was saying there, and like, as it was, you know, starting to blow over media row, I was like, oh, this is actually getting slightly scary. Maybe I should take a few steps back in case like someone pulls out a weapon or something like that. You never know, but I guess best of a bad case scenario in the end. Yeah. So we'll see if there's any more fallout. One more person we probably shouldn't be talking about in the thick of the show, but they announced it this morning. What do you think of Jake Paul versus Anthony Joshua in a boxing match, December 19th on Netflix?
Man, I didn't believe it when I first kind of heard the rumblings, but you know what? I have to give props to Jake Paul because you're taking a huge step up in competition, like a very significantly large jump up in competition. And there is no mutual agreement between them that's going to be like, hey, maybe something on the side, like, yeah, take it easy on me, Anthony. Like, no, Jake Paul's there to win. He believes he can beat Anthony Joshua. this might be too much too soon, but either way, man, like, you can say what you want about Jake Paul. You know, is he my, he's not my acquired taste. I can't say I'm a fan. But to go from Gervonta Davis up to literally up to Anthony Joshua, like, you went from punching down to punching up. Like, that's like literally and figuratively, like, you are punching up now. You went from fighting a very small guy to a very large man.
And he ain't no Julio Cesar Chavez Jr. in 2025 either. So it's like, even the last fight he actually did have, it's a massive step.
This is a big jump of a competition. I don't think it's going to go his way. But either way, man, I have to give him credit where it's due to seek out that kind of matchup. You know, Jake Paul, I give you my props.
Yeah. Anyone who thinks there's foul play to you, you just need to look a little below the surface. Anthony Joshua is staring at a 9-figure deal with DAZN and Turki Alsheikh for 2026, two fights. So if you think this guy's going to go in there and lose or let Jake Paul even make him look bad, you got another story. Of course, anyone can lose a fight, but I expect his best effort, and he's probably going to go out there and try to do him like he did Francis Ngannou.
Yeah, absolutely. I could see it. Yeah. And for Francis, I mean, the stance changes, and we could get into that. It's the past, and we have the present to talk about. But I think Jake will do a better job fighting Joshua like a boxer, whereas Francis, too many stance changes, too much cute stuff in a squared space. For, you know, you just don't walk forward changing stances. You're in a boxing ring. You know, you can do that by cutting angles, moving laterally, but on a straight line against a guy like Anthony Joshua, you're going to get caught.
Yeah. Okay, before we get into all the stuff at welterweight, finish the sentence. The number one pound-for-pound MMA fighter in the UFC right now is?
Yeah, I'd say Islam.
Yep, I agree. I know some people out there still pitching for Ilya, but I said this at the beginning, and I know if you want to go side-by-side, the win over Charles versus the win over Jack, obviously a more impressive highlight reel, but I feel like prime 28-year-old Jack Della Maddalena on an 18-fight winning streak, I still rate that as a little bit of a higher win than a vacant title victory over Charles Oliveira on a one fight winning streak at the time.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, but it's tit for tat. Maybe we see number one and number two pound for pound fight down the line. I'm sure we're going to talk about that, but yeah, I mean, I just think the dominance that Islam has displayed, and for how much, you know, he's been in the UFC a lot longer than Topuria. I think he's been in the UFC since 2014, I believe 14 or 15, a lot of time with the company, a lot of wins. You know, so for me, I'm not going to say like it's a no brainer because they're two very, very skilled fighters. But I just think right now, given what we just saw on Saturday, Friday night, Saturday morning, it was Topuria. As we speak now, from Saturday night moving forward, to me, it's Islam.
I agree. The door is a little bit open because of how the fight ends. But yeah, I agree with that one too. And I know Merab Dvalishvili, you can't forget about him too. If he gets title defense number four, he is definitely a fighter more so than anyone else, you know, competing more often. But he's missing the second division stuff right now, so it probably keeps him a little bit lower. But it's a great time. Very competitive at the top of these rankings. And don't forget about Merab, 14 wins in a row. He's going to be threatening that Anderson Silva streak too himself. So we'll see how this all turns over. But okay, Mike, a lot of stuff going on in the welterweight division.
Yeah.
A lot more things happening at UFC 322. Okay, we're going to try to make our best case for each of these guys and how they can get a title shot. And then we'll put a rating next to it and see how it comes out here. So is there anyone you first want to speak about? I'll let you take the first choice and we'll go off of them between Michael Morales, Carlos Prochas, Kamaru Usman, Shavkat Rakhmonov. I guess we could throw Ilya Topuria in there, and then Ian Machado Guerra if he wins, and Bilal Muhammad if he wins.
You know, I got to jump out with the first one, and unfortunately, we haven't seen this guy in a very long time. Shavkat Rakhmonov. I mean, he's the guy. I mean, to me, it's a shame that he's had the knee injury. But you know, the fight with Machado Guerra was labeled as a number one contender fight. He won that fight. Maybe it wasn't the performance we've seen from him in the past, but let's remember, when the best start fighting the best, you're not always going to get a finish. It's going to sometimes go from a fight to a chess match. And that's what we saw in the fight with Rakhmonov versus Machado Guerra. It turned into more of a chess match than a fight. And listen, up until that point, Shavkat had been finishing everybody. Mm-hmm. A 50-50 split on knockouts and submissions. Like, this guy is so well-rounded. He is so skilled. He is so composed. Like, the technical skills are there, but the intangibles are there as well. He's very, very tough. He showed resiliency in the Machado Guerra fight, having to battle through the MCL tear and just the injury itself and still find a way to win a 25-minute fight. That's incredible. I do think that maybe there are guys with the competitors within the division that could argue like, look, he's been active, he's been inactive. It should be me. Whoever that guy is saying, it should be me. They have the right to say that. But I just still feel like Shavkat's the guy that we should be asserting into this conversation, because let's say Sean Brady beats Michael Morales. That'd probably be the guy that I would say right now should be the number one contender. Mm-hmm. Like, Sean Brady's earned the right. Nobody wants to fight him. He was clamoring for Shavkat. Shavkat's on the sidelines. You know, Sean Brady, he would have been what, 19-1, you know, mm-hmm. I, and maybe I'm biased because I like Sean Brady a lot, common opponent. You know, I like the guys from the Philly camp, but it would have been, Brady would have been my number one guy I'd be talking about had he beat Michael Morales, but he did not. And so for me, like, Shavkat's the guy I feel like should be in the conversation, because who knows, Islam's not a guy that really turns around and fights, you know, every 3 months, 4 months, there's a little time between fights. That's enough time, hopefully, that we could get Shavkat back into fighting shape and healthy and ready to go.
Yeah, it's a good argument. It must be noted off the top for, I guess, all these conversations when Islam could fight again. Ramadan, I think, is February 27th to March like 25th or something like that. Yeah. So it's either, could they get him in on a February numbered card, which he has done that turnaround kind of like Abu Dhabi October to February in Australia. He said he took no damage. He said he's ready to go. So maybe we get a February Islam fight. If not, maybe it's not till the White House or something, you know, in that range of May to July. So that plays into account here. But if we're making the Shavkat argument, it would be maybe this guy could have been the champion already, right? He had the title fight and Bilal pulled out. Like, he, and then he showed up and he fought on that date and he beat Ian Garry. So, like, you know, how much do you want to penalize for that when the champion pulls out against the challenger? I think that's a pretty good supportive case for him. Like you said, all finishes but one, incredible fighter, undefeated. The pure image of him and Islam next to each other with the size difference and stuff, I think would be fascinating. And I don't know, like, I think there's a lot of respect those two. And I think, like, the teams don't want to see them fight just because kind of where they're from. And, like, I remember Umar Nurmagomedov was like, no, let's kick the can down the line on the Shavkat fight. So yeah. I don't know what's all going on there. But, yeah, to me, that might be the most interesting fight. It's just what holds Shavkat back is all the time off, people kind of lapping him. And, again, if you're on that team, are you doing yourself a disservice coming back from injuries and all that straight into a title fight? That's a big question.
Yeah, but a guy like Shavkat who's – I just don't think that it would rattle him that much to come in off that kind of layoff, you know, and not to mention, do you risk losing your spot? If, like, let's just say Hunter Campbell calls Shavkat's team and is like, hey, here are your options. We could give you this tune-up fight. We could give you Michael Morales, right, and then you could fight for the title, or you could just fight for the title. Listen, respectfully, and I'm not saying this is a dig at Islam, but I'm playing the devil's advocate here. Like, okay, you could come back and fight a guy that was the lightweight champ that's coming up in weight and had beat Jack Della. That's a legit win. But, like, when you look at Shavkat and the size and the physical disparities between the two, I'm not taking a chance. If the option is there to take the title fight first, I'm taking the title fight first, because there is, for Shavkat in the position he's in, there is no, like, tune-up fight. There is no, like, oh, we'll just put you in there with, like, a Usman or a Morales or any of these guys. Like, it's non-existent. It's just like, if the title fight's there, which I think it will be, you take it. If not, then he's going to have to dive into that shark infested water with these guys in the welterweight division. I mean, hopefully he can have that option to take the title fight, because I would like to see that fight happen. It would be a shame, you know, if he's going to lose his first fight coming back from an injury. I'd rather see it happen in a title fight than have him come up short against one of these, you know, savages, one of these contenders beneath him. And then you got to really fight your way back and maybe never even get there. So yeah. I want Shavkat first.
I dig it. Okay. That's all. And so what are we rating? Let's try to do like an out of 10 rating of how compelling each guy's case is. What are we giving this one? Like a 8.5 or something? Cause we're going to have, this is the bar that we're going to be comparing all other arguments to. So what are you thinking?
You know, I would say I have to be realistic. It's the layoff. The layoff is really, this would be a 10 across the board.
Yep.
If this fight was happening, you know, not if this was like on a regular timeline. Mm-hmm. But it's not, you know, there's the injury, the layoff, guys winning fights since then, guys that have very valid cases to say why they should be next and not him because of how much time he spent away. I'm going to go 8.5.
8.5. Okay. Let's do that out of 10. Okay. I'll pick the next guy here just because this is probably going to be the most conversation invoking Kamaru Usman, who I guess the biggest thing he has in his corner shares a manager with Islam. Islam's out there post fight saying, "I want to fight this guy. Like, I think Usman, if I have my choice, he's the one." Usman's doing the media rounds. He's got the legacy name. He's got the title defense record at number two behind GSP in this weight class. Like, it is. It has shades of John Jones and Stipe to a degree. You know, obviously Stipe was on more losses, and Kamaru, to his credit, did get the win over Buckley, so you can't hate on that too much. But I don't know, like, this one, I don't know how much the fans want it and all that stuff, but both fighters seem to want it, and they have the support of a powerful manager. Do they have the support of the UFC, though? That's what I wonder. And who knows? I mean, maybe style-wise, maybe it is the hardest fight. A guy who's extremely good at wrestling, maybe he can, you know, turn that into a striking fight more with Islam and give himself a chance there. Maybe style-wise, it is interesting, but maybe there's some Kamaru Usman fatigue out there from the fans and the people who would be paying for this fight.
Well, let's just start with the X's and O's, because this to me is one of the more interesting potential fights for Islam. And a lot of it revolves around what you said right off the top, the same manager. But let's just start with the skills.
Yeah.
Whether you like this fight or not, or let's just say you don't like this fight. You're burned out on Kamaru Usman and, you know, things of that sort. At the end of the day, stylistically, this would be a very, very fun fight, because listen, how is Islam just going to go out there and seemingly take Usman down and control him and dominate him in the grappling? Could he even do that? Chimaev couldn't even do it on short notice.
Yeah.
If that was a 5-round fight, Kamaru very well could have beat Chimaev. And I don't want to play this coulda, woulda, shoulda game, but that's just the reality. If you go back and watch that Chimaev fight, that was a close fight. Him coming up a weight class on short notice. This is what happens in style matchups like this. When a powerful grappler and MMA guy goes against a guy like Kamaru, who's displayed nearly flawless wrestling offensively and defensively, you know what happens. They're going to get stuck on the feet. And that makes for a very fun fight, because we've shown, like I talked about with Islam and Poirier. Poirier was able to defend some takedowns and force Islam into some boxing exchanges. And Islam did shine. He had success. He damaged Dustin. He landed good shots. He's got good knees. He's dangerous from the clinch. And for Kamaru, I mean, all you got to do is go back and watch the knockout of Jorge Masvidal. The guy's got serious power in his hands. I think it makes for a very fun fight. I think both of them would try to test the waters and trying to take one another down. And I think that they would both get just caught in this in a fight where they'd be forced to stand up, because I don't think either of them could take the other one down and control them. I don't think if Kamaru took Islam down, Islam is getting right back up. I don't think Islam could take down Kamaru, respectfully. Kamaru's got phenomenal takedown defense. Now let's get into the other stuff. Yeah, there's the Kamaru Usman fatigue, and maybe there's something with the UFC where it's like, you have to look at how much time is left ahead of each of these fighters. And there's way more time ahead for Islam, given his age, compared to Kamaru Usman. If Kamaru wins the title, would this be a situation where he tries to stick around and defend, or would he just retire? You know, and that's really not what the UFC wants to see, especially if
not in this division right now.
Not in this division, no. And it's like if you look at GSP when he retired after the Bisping fight, that's not what he was supposed to sign up for. And he kind of had a fight. He had to kind of argue his way into that fight. So if Kamaru got the next fight with Islam, it would take Ali having to persuade them. Like, he would have to convince the powers that be. The one thing that does favor Kamaru is, if Islam wants to turn around fast and fight before Ramadan, Kamaru's ready to go. Kamaru is always in the gym. He's always in shape. Like, I've worked the desk with him a handful of times. And, you know, the guy is still jacked. His weight is still on point. He's still a guy. They could have called Kamaru, I guarantee you, on 10 days notice if JDM pulled out.
He told me when I interviewed him early in fight week that he would be ready for like a February, March type of fight. So,
and I even think that if something happened, you know, at the 11th hour, you know, right before 322, I think that he could have made weight and stepped into that welterweight title fight. He's always in good shape. And that's what he's gearing up for. Kamaru's not sticking around for paychecks. Kamaru wants to fight for the title. He showed in the Buckley fight, where he was a huge underdog, that he can still compete and beat some of these young bucks. Kamaru could get out there and beat Islam. That's just the reality of it. He could definitely threaten Islam with the skills that he possesses and how ready he is to fight. He's definitely ready for a title fight right now.
Yeah, I mean, the style matchup there and the breakdown there, that's super fascinating. And I think as a fight in a different situation, that's maybe it. But Kamaru 1-3 in the past four, and you can't look over that. And especially when you have how many undefeated guys, like how many guys on multiple fight winning streaks doing all that stuff, it's hard. But if Islam really stumps for it and he really wants it, and it's hard to, you know, do that sometimes. They might concede and know this might be their last opportunity for a Kamaru Usman fight. But yeah, you got to get him on board. And I did ask that because I remember he said in an interview a few months ago, he's like, my dream ending is win the welterweight title, go up to middleweight, win that title, and then retire. I'm like, do you know how much the UFC would hate to hear like that plan? Like, that's like the UFC's worst. So you're going to ruin two divisions and vacate two belts without defending them? Like,
yeah, no, well,
so I brought that up to him, and he's like, no, like, I want to beat this next wave of contenders. So maybe he's coming down to earth a little bit on that plan.
Well, and the reality is as well, like, we're not doing the double champ thing anymore. Like, we're going to let guys go up and challenge. We're going to let the champions, if you want to go up and fight at a higher weight class or a lower weight class, you know, and you've cleaned out your division, like, yeah, we'll let you relinquish your title and move up, but we're not doing the double champ thing anymore. And even then, like, it is kind of hard when, you know, in, before I say anything, like, you know, and I'm not trying to get too far in the weeds and, you know, we're on a time constraint here, but like, it is kind of weird when it's like, okay, we, Jean-Weili relinquishes the title. Mackenzie Dern just won the, you know, now inaugural strawweight title. And then now Jean-Weili goes up to fight Valentina at flyweight. Now what happens? Does Jean-Weili like, it didn't go well, I'm going to come back down.
Yeah.
Now we have this weird, which she should, but it's a weird conversation to be had. So if Kamaru wins the title and tries to do that type of situation, I'm not super keen on it. I wouldn't be upset if Kamaru got the next fight. You know, some of these guys like him and Gaethje, you're not going to have much time left with them. And if they've earned the right to even be in the conversation of a title fight, and maybe the water's a little murky in terms of who should be next because we're spoiled with the riches of these contenders, like, screw it. Like, let's just throw him in there, squeeze the Kamaru Usman fruit for every last drop, and let's use him while we got him. And if he can win, it's a great storyline, but it still would be a very hard fight for him.
Yep. So we're rating the Kamaru Usman title shot case at what? It's definitely lower than Shavkat in my mind, or do you feel it's stronger?
The thing that favors Kamaru the most in this situation is the readiness. He's just ready to go, you know? Yeah. So if
we know he's healthy,
we know he's healthy, he's ready to fight. He wants to fight for the title. You know, I give it a
6.5. Okay. I like that one. All right. We're going to leave Bilal and Gary to the end since we're going to kind of make that part of our preview for Qatar. Who do you like next to make a case for between Ilia Topuria, Carlos Prochez, and Michael Morales?
Okay, so... Oh, man.
We're going to talk about them all, so whoever
you want. Yeah, you know, for the next one, good, because I thought I was going to have to pick one because I have something to say for each guy. Let's save what's the most lucrative one for last. Let's save Topuria. Okay. Let's talk Prochez. Look, man, I'm as big of a fan as anybody is the UFC's Marlboro man, the smoking gunslinger out of Brazil. He's got swag. He's got style. He's got presence. Like, there's something like when Carlos Prochez walks in a room, he's just a captivating guy. Like, he's just, he has a presence. He has an aura, and he's got a style of fighting that the fans absolutely love. And I'm a fan first. I'm a fan before I'm a fighter, before I'm an analyst. Like, I am with you guys. I am a fan. I love Carlos Prochez. I love what he has, what he brings to the octagon with his style, with his striking, how comfortable he is, the gamesmanship. Like, I love the little clip going around of like when Leon has his back on the feet and he's kind of like hitting him with these short shots and he's just kind of like looking bored. In these last two wins, man, the spinning elbow of Jeff Neal at 319, which very well could be knockout of the year, was incredible. Jeff Neal, one of the hardest punchers pound for pound in the UFC, has an incredible chin, extremely durable, and Prochez went just right into the fire. Not many people go right into the fire against a guy like Jeff Neal. The only other person that has done that is Shavkat Rakhmonov, and even then, Shavkat took a lot of big shots that fight. He got hit with some hard shots. Jeff Neal had his moments in that fight.
Yeah.
Ultimately, Shavkat ended up getting the submission late in the third round, but Prochez went out there against Jeff Neal and seemingly made it look easy, respectfully. I feel like I'm saying respectfully too much. I'll leave that out. I'm just doing
we respect everyone here.
I'm just doing my job, guys. I'm sorry. But you know how the fighters are. Like, you're an analyst and you just break it down like, oh, dude, I can't tell you how many times Jamal Hill has tried to kill me in Yusuf Zawal. They've all tried to kill me. But yeah, so I mean, Prochaska goes out there against Jeff Neal. It goes right into the fire, gets the knockout, and then against Leon Edwards. I've always said that Leon Edwards, the one thing he needed to work on that we saw like in the Bilal fight and in the JDM fight, or yeah, the Bilal fight and in the Sean Brady fight, is he gets stuck southpaw. So if you don't change stances, it's hard to evade pressure. And so in this fight against Prochaska, we're seeing him start to change stances. And then it worked against him because he switched to orthodox and Prochaska stepped so far across his lead foot, took away all that space and landed that beautiful left straight. And that was all she wrote. You know, I think that Prochaska is a very interesting guy to throw into a fight. The problem is the wrestling. Like, and I'm not one of these guys that's jumped ship on the Fighting Nerds. I still think they're one of the best teams in the sport. I think they're all incredible fighters. I think the coaching staff there is great. What they've done with analytics and hiring guys to break down film and bringing in third parties. Like, they do a lot of great things, but there is a glaring gap in the wrestling, and Prochaska is going to have to fill that gap, because if you just try to wade yourself into the fire against a guy like Islam, you're just walking into takedowns. You can't just go in on a straight line as a striker against a guy like Islam and expect to not get taken down. That would work so well in Islam's favor, but the one shot power is there. I mean, Prochaska is the type of guy, like we saw in the Machado Gary fight. That fight got into deep waters and he almost knocked Machado Gary out. He could be down for love and shut your lights off in the fifth round. He has that type of power, and it wouldn't be some type of lucky strike. It would be something very well placed. Mm-hmm. The problem is, like, two wins in a row, but after he beat Leon Edwards, look who goes up. Look who's up next. We're like, holy crap, Prochaska is the next guy. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, Michael Morales is like, hold my beer, watch this. You know, like, that's the problem. Is I would have Prochaska way higher up the ladder in terms of potentially being next, but there's no way you're ahead of Michael Morales. There's just no way. There's no way you're ahead of Michael Morales. So for me, I would rate this fight, I would have to say a 5. I would have to say a 5, just because, like, dude, it's just those two knockouts alone are enough to warrant the shot. But just like Michael Morales, like, spoiled the party. Like, it really, if it wasn't for Michael Morales, I would probably have him at like probably like a 7.5. But given the fact Morales did what he did, you jump way down the ladder. I got to give it a 5. But man, would I be upset if he got the next shot? Absolutely not. I'd be thrilled. Like I said, I'm a big fan of the guy in and out of the octagon. He's a ton of fun. There are times when, like, I think, like, man, I hope I get to meet Carlos Prochaska outside of T-Mobile Arena and, but, like, bum a cigarette off him and smoke a cigarette with him. I'm being honest. Like, I just think the guy's incredible. So,
hey, I've been there. I bummed him smokes when we were in Perth, and he was like, they're like $45 a pack down here. Like, does anyone have any? I didn't have enough money to buy more. And I just, like, threw him one on the stage back when I used to
be a That's bit more awesome.
But yeah, it's, he's hilarious. He's got a great thing going for him. But yeah, I tend to agree. He feels like he's going to be the lower end of this totem pole. Ian Gary loss would go a long way for him, I think, given the situation. If Ian wins big, it's kind of hard to overlook that. And yeah, maybe it just comes around where, like, Morales is like, hey, as he said post fight, I'm not rushing the title shot. I'm still so young. Maybe it's just kind of like situational. But yeah, given where he's at, I mean, all due respect, Leon now on a 3-fight losing skid. Jeff Neal has lost 3 of 4. His only win there was RDA kind of hurting his knee early in the fight too. So, like, it's not like he's beating all these guys when they're at the absolute pinnacle on super long winning streaks. Yeah. So that kind of places. I have a feeling he might be at the bottom. Maybe Sands won for different reasons, but we'll get into that.
But before we move on,
yes,
dare I say this? Now, I know we're not going to talk about potential fights for these guys going forward.
No, we can.
But
give us your idea.
Oh, it's a no-brainer. You do JDM and Prochaska. JDM's going to want to get himself back into a title fight, as every champion would. You lose your belt, you're going to want it right back. They're not going to give him that immediate title fight. Prochaska, there's some meat on the bone, and sometimes you want to give a guy like Prochaska a stylistically favorable fight to get him in that title fight because he has so much pull with the fans. You're like, let's give him a guy that's obviously elite, a former world champion, much like Leon was. Then it's like, if you can go out and beat JDM, who was just a champion, and now it's like, 3 wins in a row, 2 former champs, boom, you just punched your ticket. That's a main event on a fight night. That's a 5-round co-main event on a pay-per-view. That would be one of the best. If they make that fight, I will go out and say it right now, that would be one of the, if not the best, most exciting fights or finishes that we will see in 2026. That's the fight to make. That's Prochaska's ticket to the title fight. Is you go fight JDM next. You fight him, you beat him, you're next.
Hell yeah, I love that. That sounds like a great fight night main event. There's a rumor for an Australia show in February. Carlos Prochus's daughter lives in Australia, so I'm sure he'd love the free trip to go visit her. So yeah, that's all clicking there. I said, and this was like immediate post-fight, JDM and Sean Brady made a little sense in my mind, just to see, like, you know, is this a glaring hole in JDM's game, or is it just an off night? Like, can he stop a guy who's going to try to do this? How will Sean Brady react to getting, you know, hit by a big puncher again? That seems to be a little bit of a concern around him, but who knows? They like to go all sorts of directions. It used to be like guy off a loss, guy off a loss, guy off a win, guy off a win, but that's not the case how they do matchmaking anymore. So we'll see. But I love that suggestion. That's a great one. Okay, let's go on to the aforementioned many times Michael Morales here. Woo! Before we get to Ilya. This one's obviously kind of a no-brainer. He just goes out there, finishes the number two ranked guy in the first round, guy who had just finished Leon Edwards in his fight prior, was on a great roll there. We all know Sean Brady and thought highly of him going in there. And yeah, he steamrolls him. He looks like he has not many weaknesses right now. He's got a look to him. He got the most questions of anyone at the pre-fight press conference. They did an entire second press conference session with him post-fight for only Spanish language questions. He's getting like some unique treatment here. He's got some aura around him. He's got the hair, all that type of stuff. And then obviously the fighting style is impressive too. You just wonder, there is some unknowns, but everyone says that his grappling and his wrestling is actually better than his striking. So we'll see about that. It's all there. It's just a question of, do you want to do it now? Do you pull the trigger on the 26-year-old and just go right into this at 7-0 in the UFC, 19-0 in MMA?
Okay. Before I get into this, I got to tell a little story.
Yeah, please.
When Michael Morales fought Neil Magny and he beat Neil Magny, I was working the desk that night and he was asking the reporters, where's Michael Chiesa at? You know what I'm thinking? Hell no, buddy. Come on, dude. I'm old, man. Jeez, dude. I mean, that guy's incredible. If I had to fight him, I would fight him. If that was the next fight, when I got that number next to my name, you know, I got to defend my spot. I'll take all comers. I truly believe I can beat any given man on any given night. But when he first said it, I'm like,
yeah.
If there's a better option for me out there, I'm taking that, because that kid is so good. And what's making him so good, Mike, is he is, every time he steps out there, it's not every fighter gets better the more you see him fight, especially in when they're in their prime, when they're in their youth. You're always going to see like skill improvement. If you're not seeing skill improvement, you're going to fall down the ladder. You're going to lose fights. But what he has done through the course of his UFC career is just start to settle in. I feel like the skills have always been there, but he's just kind of wild. Like you said, like they say he's a better grappler and a wrestler than he is a striker, but he's out here striking. He's not playing to his strengths. It's, you would see him like, you know, in the Max Griffin fight, kind of coming forward, falling over his feet, throwing big punches. I believe he lost a round to Max Griffin and a round to Jake Matthews. And both of those guys are incredible fighters. But when you're undefeated and you're young and you're kind of given these fights where they're testing you, but you should go out there and win handedly, you're kind of dropping rounds, almost struggling, like you're not struggling in a sense like you're trying to put it together, but just like it makes sense now when you hear that he's a better grappler than he is a striker, because he's trying to strike, he's trying to give the fans what they want. But what he has done is he's just started to settle in. The Gilbert Burns fight was the first time that we saw Michael Morales set his feet and place shots. It's the first time I've really seen him do that on multiple occasions. A lot of times it's kind of blitzing coming forward, kind of overwhelming guys with his size, his strength, his physical presence, his power. But that Gilbert Burns fight, he was just setting his feet. He was picking shots, looking for knockout shots, not just winging, but just placing them. And once I saw him do that, I said, now this guy's going to be a real problem. Now this guy, once he's able to set his feet, pick his knockout shots, he's going to force guys into bad takedown attempts where he can stuff them and really pour it on him. And then you just see what he did to Sean. Sean, I said this after he lost to Bilal. I was talking to somebody from Philly about it. And I said, man, the way Sean is built, he should just lock his traps and just fight these guys on a straight line. Like, lock your chin. Like, I feel like Sean a lot of times wants to play kick and run, wants to show he's a technical fighter. He's a guy that's a big fan of GSP. Maybe he's trying to be too much like the guy he looks up to. If you try to play kick and run against a guy like Michael Morales, it's a recipe for disaster. The movement is good, but I didn't like the naked kicks. I didn't like the way Sean has this tendency to where he will get caught leaning to the right side, like trying to evade punches. Like, he'll evade to his right side. but he won't reset. And he got caught leaning too hard to the right, and he kept getting hit on that side. And you can't absorb shots like that from Michael Morales. I think for Sean, I think his best bet would have been attempting to come forward. You can move side to side, but fight this guy in a straight line. Keep your feet on the ground. Fight forward. Get on your front foot. Try to find takedowns. Test Michael Morales. Like, Michael Morales, I believe, is like an Ecuadorian national champion in wrestling. Like, challenge him there. Mm-hmm. And he just didn't seem to do that. And maybe that's just because he got in there with him. And Michael, from what I've heard, I've seen him in person, but I've heard from Bilal that like Michael Morales showed up to help him for Leon, and he was like 217. Yeah, but like, huge. But like in shape, like not maybe fight shape, but like in shape, 217, like you're a light heavyweight. And
yeah. It's like an Alex Pereira at middleweight thing. You're like, what?
100%. And that's not me calling him a weight bully. No. That's just, he's young and he's able to make the weight. He's putting it all together, man. He really is. And while we didn't see, this was the fight to test Morales. Like, let's see how he does against a powerful wrestler grappler. Let's see how he does. But he just did that with Burns. But let's give him the tougher version of that. Let's give him Sean Brady, the guy that beat Burns. Let's do that. And he passed that test. If I'm the UFC and I'm looking at the attention he's getting and the performances that he has put on in his last two fights, and just the overall growth from the time he fought on Contender Series to now, and how much more polished and refined that he is looking in his performances, what's wrong with the idea of having a young champion? Do we want to see, you know what makes John Jones's legacy so great? It's not all the attention and all the hoopla outside the octagon. It's the fights. It's him being the youngest champion in UFC history and him going on this insane run and beating all these former champions and cementing his legacy and then going up to heavyweight and winning the title. Michael Morales could do that. Like, he is showing that he has got a lot of promise. This guy is popping at the seams with potential. Skill-wise, in how his presence out of the octagon, he is the complete package. As a fighter in and out of the octagon, as a competitor, and just as a guy on the other side of a camera, he is the complete package. And I think that it wouldn't be a bad idea to put him in a title fight sooner than later, because the idea of him going on a very long run, like we saw from John Jones, the sport needs something like that. I think that that's what we need. We need to see a young champion.
I'm with you. I think for my post-fight matchmaker video, I said Michael Morales. I think he is the one here who should get our highest rating. Go all in on it, man. Like, if he can become the champion 20-0 by beating fucking Islam Makhachev, number one pound for pound in the world. Yeah, like, this is the stuff of dreams. Then you attach a rocket ship to this guy. Again, like, sitting here, him and Shavkat, you know, basically similar things, same record, a very high finishing rate, all that stuff. But I've covered many Shavkat fights. The people from Kazakhstan come out and support him. Nothing like this. It was a different scene there in New York with the amount of media that came pre post fight, asking every single fighter on the card, what do you think of Michael Morales? The media pulling me aside after media day, give us your breakdown and prediction of the fight to every media member in the room. Like, it's a different level there. So I think you go all in, you put your eggs in his basket, see what happens. And you just hope that even if he comes up short against Islam, he doesn't get humiliated. And it's not one where like this guy just got badly exposed and he's going to get messed up by any wrestler he faces in the division. I don't feel it would be that way, but that's, I guess, the downside risk of if he goes in there and loses dominantly.
I mean, just the size alone, like,
yeah, it's hard to picture, but
it's hard to imagine. I mean, that the size difference alone and the fact that he has a good understanding of wrestling and grappling, I think that he could give Islam a lot of problems. I mean, and if he can force Islam into a stand-up fight, that's a very hard fight. Islam, that's a fight where it's like, you have to get the takedown. I could see Islam, if he couldn't take Shavkat down, I could see Islam being able to compete with Shavkat on the feet. I could see him in a world winning a decision against a Shavkat if he's having to mix the striking and the wrestling and being forced into some exchanges. I think he could still find ways to win that fight if he can't get it into his wheelhouse and dominate in the grappling. I don't think he could do that against Morales. And Morales can force him into a stand-up fight. I just don't see, especially, like I said, the composure that he's exhibiting in these last two fights, being able to pick his shots, set his feet. That'd be a really hard night at the office for Islam. So my rating for Mr. Morales.
Let's go. 10. Wow. We're leaving no room for anyone else to exceed him. He is the guy. He is a 10.
Wow. Fucking 10.
I tend to agree. I think I would have put it at like the 9.5 just because nothing is certain in MMA, but I like the confidence. 10.
Give it to him. Why not? Like, dude, you have a win like that. Like, especially just as a fighter, the best thing you can do for yourself, if you want to be a champion, the best thing you can do for yourself is get yourself in high profile fight. on the same night that your belt is on the line in your weight class. And he was the last fight before the welterweight title fight, the last welterweight fight before the welterweight title fight, I should say. I mean, it's right there for the taking. He took no damage. Like, let's do it. I think I'd like to see him. I'd like to see a young champion like that. I'd like to see somebody have an opportunity and a chance to try. Records are meant to be broken. That's just the reality of it. Maybe if you're the record holder, you don't feel that way. But as an analyst and as a fan, records are meant to be broken. Let's put a fighter in a situation where they can go chase greatness and try to beat one of the greatest records in UFC history, which is John Jones' title fight record. I'm here for it.
Even GSP is at welterweight. It would be insane. Yeah. I think he got 10. So that's 5, 6, 7 years of work. So we'll see. Yeah. I really like his argument. I think he's got a very strong chance here. It's interesting when Islam got asked at the press conference, who do you think was more impressive? He did mention Prochess, but I think he's just kind of confused about how this guy can smoke cigarettes and win fights. Like, how it registers in Islam's brain is like something that makes sense. So I think that was more.
I mean, what's honestly the difference? Like, a lot of fighters smoke pot, you know, I mean, come on. It's not, maybe it just makes your lungs stronger. Who fucking knows?
Yeah.
Either way, like, it is incredible. But
okay. So where does this? Yeah. Number 10 there. So yeah. I don't know. I don't think we can make a stronger case for Ilia Topuria. And I wasn't even planning to anyways, but we got to mention him. I think if we brought this up pre-fight, it's maybe more interesting, the hypothetical of him in an Islam fight. I'm trying to be positive here on Mr. Topuria's side, but the reason you make this fight, I guess the strongest argument, he could be the first guy to win UFC titles in 3 weight classes. The history of it alone for Ilia's side, for the UFC photo, where instead of two belts over the shoulders, you have two over the shoulder and one around the waist. Like, this is all stuff you could promote from here to infinity. It would be iconic. But as a fight, I don't know how I feel anymore with Islam looking how he did. I don't know. What's the case you can make, since you want to save this one for the last out of the group? What's your argument?
Well, I'll tell you this. A lot of people don't know this about Ilia Topuria. Before he got in the UFC, this guy shined as a grappler.
Yep.
Powerful grappler, very dominant, big takedown, submission attempts. The guy is incredible when it comes to his ground skills. Obviously, he's shined with his boxing since he's been in the UFC. And hey, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But this would be the fight where he would get tested in the wrestling or grappling. And I think this would be between Islam and Ilia. I think this fight has the potential to be chaotic. This has the potential to be a fight kind of similar maybe to Islam's fight with Dustin Poirier. You know, the first time we've really seen Islam kind of have to battle a little more adversity and force into some exchanges, take some damage, get some takedowns defended. I think Topuria could put on that type of performance, and he could very well win. He's got more power than Dustin Poirier does. You cannot absorb shots from Ilia Topuria. He's got one-shot KO power, one of the hardest punchers in the UFC for sure. But this is
would be at welterweight, though.
Yeah, and this is the thing. It would be a welterweight, and I do think power does translate when you go up weight classes. But here's the problem. Like, you haven't cleaned out lightweight yet. He cleaned out featherweight respectfully. He went through the featherweight division. It got a little too hard for him in terms of the weight cut. He is a very dense guy. If you've ever met Topuria, you shake his hand, you pat him on the back. Like, the guy is just built different. He's solid. So like 155 is the right weight class for him. The idea of him winning 3 belts in 3 weight classes, it would be iconic. That idea first came in my head when Henry Cejudo talked about it. And I did love the idea of like, holy crap, could you imagine if a guy won 3 titles in 3 weight classes? That'd be something else. Someone will do it eventually. But I just think that there's still so much left for him at 155 pounds in terms of contenders. Like, Armand Sarukian was supposed to fight him, and he's waiting in the wings. He's got a big fight coming up this weekend. You know, Paddy Pimblett, you know, one of the most polarizing fighters in the UFC right now, one of the most beloved, one of the guys with the biggest following. And there's a storyline there, and there's beef. And then you got Gaethje waiting in the wings. It's kind of in that similar Kamaru Usman space where it's like, you know, Gaethje won his last fight. And granted, he was respectfully and rightfully the number one contender, but he rolled the dice and fought Max Holloway. Feels the UFC owes him a favor, whether that is true or not. That's completely behind closed doors. Mm-hmm. So one side saying one thing, one side saying the other. Nonetheless, I don't feel like that's any of our business. That's between Justin Gaethje and the UFC.
Sure.
But I just named 3 names. He has to beat at least 2 of them before he moves on. Like, he has to pick between Paddy or Gaethje. And then if Sarukian beats Hooker, he has to beat Hooker. So he is 2 wins away from earning the right to go up and challenge for the welterweight title, because there's still guys there that need to be beat. If he can get through those 2 guys, if he can get through 2 of those 3 guys in 2 fights, sure, let him do it. And if Islam's still around for it, I'd love to see it happen. I would love to see Ilya Topuria or any UFC fighter for that matter be the first to win three belts in three weight classes. But I just think right now is not the time. It's not the next guy. To me, business wise, it doesn't make sense. As a fan, it'd be fucking amazing. I mean, yeah. Let's be honest. That'd be an incredible matchup wise, stylistically. Yeah. That's a fucking
power, all that
that's stuff. A phenomenal fight. That would be an amazing fight. World-class mixed martial arts displayed in the highest degree would be those two fighting. But now's not the time.
It's crazy how quickly this damn game changes, because it felt like it was the time for, 6 or 7 months there. And then these two guys win. But who knows? Maybe we get a 20-0 Ilya Topuria versus Islam on an 18-fight UFC winning streak. And maybe this is the biggest thing ever. The only maybe X factor here is if President Trump maybe calls up Dana and Hunter and the crew and says, this is the fight I want as the main event for the White House, make it happen, boys. And then maybe we're playing by a different set of rules there. I'm just saying, trying to include all the intangibles
here. I'm sure Sean Shelby would love Donald Trump doing his matchmaking. Yes, I'm sure he would love that. He'd be thrilled. He could say that. Trump has a better odds or a better case of being like, hey, you have to put John Jones on this card. You have a better case for that
than trying
to force a matchup in a situation like it's a fun fight, but respectfully, it doesn't make sense right now. It just doesn't. It's a fight that it just doesn't make sense. Logistically, it's not the right fight right now. We could have this conversation at the end of 2026.
Yeah.
You have Topuria fight two times, end of 2026. Boom. He wins those two fights. Screw it. Let's do it. Let's do the next big crazy marquee UFC we're going to have after the White House. I don't know if it's on fucking Mars or some shit. you get done with the sphere.
We don't know what's going to come next.
You're what's next after the fucking sphere? Well, now we're at the White House. So,
Are you going complete opposite spectrum? Are you giving Ilya a zero? Or are you going
to
give
I'm not giving him a zero because I have to respect what that fight would represent. That fight, a real chance to cement yourself as the best of all time. You win three belts in three weight classes. It doesn't matter how many title defenses you have. It doesn't matter what your win streak is, if you're undefeated or not. Yeah. If you've captured three belts in three different weight classes in the UFC, you are the absolute best. And I don't think it would be up for debate. But I have to give it probably an eight. I'd still give it an eight because it's still, like I said, the fight itself and what it would mean in order for Ilya to get there. Even if he did it now, it's a great shot to achieve something, incredible. But I just don't think, in due time, if he could win a few more fights and it actually happens, I think it'd be one of the biggest fights, if not the biggest fight in the UFC. I just don't think we need that big of a fight right now when there's plenty of other big fights to be made.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think it's, before this whole weekend happened, different conversation. Ilya, that felt like the hottest fight you can make in the sport. But now I want to see what Islam can do against these welterweights and how much he can enhance his legacy by, trying to do a lap of this welterweight division. So very interesting. Yeah. This episode of the Bonfire Podcast is brought to you by MyBookie. For all of your UFC betting needs, use MyBookie.ag. Whether it's straight bets, money lines, prop bets, over-unders, parlays, everything and more, MyBookie has it all to enhance your UFC betting experience. Use the code word BON, B-O-H-N, for a first-time player bonus. Ahead of UFC Qatar this weekend. Lots of exciting and interesting matchups and action there. If you want to do anything when it comes to betting, go to mybookie.ag and please make sure to bet responsibly. Okay, we'll do this as a hybrid preview for UFC Qatar and talking about the same thing with Bilal Muhammad, Ian Machado, Gary. I guess on the Muhammad side, should we just say right off the bat, is he the zero here? For all these years, he says, I won't fight Islam. There's the whole thing with the Islam friendship, and he didn't want to do that fight. Him losing is basically the reason Islam came up. You can't change your energy when the roles are reversed, right? And I will give a little bit of a spoiler. He did not when I talked to him a few hours ago.
Oh, so he still said that he wouldn't fight Islam.
I'll show you the clip shortly here. Give me your thoughts first.
Well, you kind of shot yourself in the foot, Bilal. I mean, and I'm a Bilal fan. Yeah. I was one of the few people out there. I feel like he was just not getting the respect that he deserved. I was one of the few people out there saying, give this guy a shot. He's won so many fights in a row, and winning is winning at the end of the day. And you should be rewarded for winning. And I felt like it was poetic justice to see him win the welterweight title because he was all but counted out. He had to win all these fights. He had to fight Gilbert Burns in a 5-round main event on short notice. And he had to really jump through a lot of hoops to earn a shot. And he did it and he won the belt. But two things. I think that with how I mean, if he could go out and knock Ian Machado Gary out, like if he could go out there and spark him, like, okay, you might get the next shot. Like just because you just had the belt, your first fight back from losing it, you knock out Ian Machado Gary, which hasn't been done yet. Okay, you punched your ticket. Oh, wait, dang it, I don't want to fight Islam. Well, then it's all for nothing. So, you know, unless there's some type of something we don't know behind the scenes with Ali and his relationship with his fighters, like if Islam's like, you know, if Bilal, you know, wins this fight and they give him a title fight, would Islam vacate and go back down to fight Ilya? Because there is another reality where that fight could still happen sooner than later if Islam's like, oh, I'll go down to lightweight and fight him.
Yeah. He doesn't seem to want to do that. And I don't want to
go back down after you've made you that 15 extra pounds, Mike.
You know.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
When he says, like, oh, I would go back down to lightweight, I'm like, you're going to make 170 the first time and say, fuck no. Like, there's no way. Like, you couldn't pay me enough to go back down to 155 pounds. I'm sure he feels the same way. So for Bilal, yeah, it just feels weird saying this. As much as I was one of the few that pulled for him to get that title fight, and as happy as I was for him to see him win that belt, and how much poetic justice it was for him to win that title. The fact that you won't fight Islam, there's nothing. I mean, it's like, it doesn't matter what you do or how you win. If you won't fight him, you won't fight him. So there's no point in even putting it on the scale as to like how lucrative of a fight this would be. You know what would make it lucrative? Oh, I would fight my teammate. We haven't had that yet. Bilal says, I would fight my teammate. I'm going to beat Ian Machado Gary, and I'm going to retract what I said. I would fight my teammate next. Well, guess what? You're getting up in the eights. Because that's the one thing we haven't seen in the UFC, going all the way back to the AKA era. Josh Koscheck, Mike Swick, John Fitch, we're never going to fight each other. Mirab Davalishvili, Aljamain Sterling, and I respect that. I was in the same situation on Ultimate Fighter. Dominic Cruz was trying to get me to fight my teammate, Sam Cecilia. I wouldn't have been there without him. And I said, no fucking way. But you know what me and Sam did agree on? If it was for the championship. If we were on opposite teams and we had to fight each other, fuck it. I would rather, if he knocks my fucking head off and wins it, I'd rather have my head knocked off by him than somebody else. Yeah. You know what I mean? That's not my first option. That was my last option. That's not what I ever wanted, but that was the reality that we faced. Now for Islam and Bilal.
And they're not even true teammates. Also, shout out to Ante Dillia.
And that's the thing. It's like, this would be a way different conversation if he was open to it. Then it's like, okay, now that's interesting. The you know, friendships collide, you know, the storyline with like teammates fighting teammates. Like, granted, I can't, you know, I'm not pushing for that because I was so against it myself. But like I said, we did have an understanding. Like, we might have to do this. We might not have a choice. This is what we signed up for, you know. So for Bilal and Islam, I just think the fact that Bilal won't fight him, there's nothing to talk about. I mean, but for Machado Gary.
We'll get to him in a second. I want to play you this Bilal clip because he did slightly leave the door open. Okay. Let's see what you think about this. This is both his assessment of the fight and what would happen with a win. Hesitant to give a very thorough and broken down prediction. What are you going to do to Ian Gary in there on Saturday?
Honestly, for me, it's I think Ian's going to try to run around the whole first round. But then by the end of the first round, his little point jabbing is not going to work. Then I'm going to grab a hold of him. I'm going to take him down. I'm going to let him back up just because I want to show him that I could take you down if I want to. And then I'm going to outbox him because he said he could outstrike me. He thinks he's a pretty striker. He's been in there with some great strikers, right? He's been there with MVP. He's been there with Shavkat. He's been there with Protas. And none of them guys finished him. So for me, it's finishing him on the feet and then reminding everybody who I am.
Damn, I mean, that would be a hell of a statement, but what does it do here? I mean, obviously the elephant in the room, Islam is now the champion. Does this change your future plans here? I know you've talked about maybe middleweights, like, is that in play? Or what do you think the victory, if you get it the way you want to, what does this all mean?
I mean, we're looking at Jake Paul. No, I'm messing with you. For myself, it's only focusing on one guy, man. I don't want to look past anybody. I'm only looking at Saturday. Ask me that question Sunday, I'll give you an answer.
First and foremost, I will say this, Mike Bond. Bilal, I love the guy, but this, if you fucking take him down, just keep him there. Don't let him up. This desire to go box costs you your title. Like Jack Della, you went out and you fought him. You fought a great fight and you didn't even fight to your strengths.
You got to have regret looking at Islam's fight, right?
You just, like, if I'm Bilal, like, no, just go take him down, beat him up, and dominate. I hope he's just gassing. I hope it's like, don't let him up if you get the first takedown. Beat him up, take him down, steal his will. Don't go out there and just box him. Like, it's like, I can always respect a fighter that thinks like that. Like a lot of times you're like, I'm going to beat him at what he's best at. I'm in such good shape. I do everything so well, blah, blah, blah. But like, I just don't think that that's the right game plan, the right approach. We'll see if he wins, which he very well could, if he's going to call for a shot against Islam. Like I said, this weird thing, Ali always seems to come up in these conversations, right? You notice how we're just like, maybe him and Ali have this plan that we don't know about, you know, like Ali's just in the dark, you know, pulling all the strings. Like, who
I actually
knows?
Just got a text asking if I want to interview Ali tomorrow so I can ask him all these questions. His ears are burning, apparently.
Yeah, because look, he's like he's in, you know, Kamaru Usman, Islam, Bilal, you know, he's just kind of got, like I said, he's pulling all the puppet strings. Maybe they're talking about this. Maybe. Because if for Ali, not just from like a for fiscal motivations, I guess you could say money motivations, but like, your job as a manager is to get your fighters the biggest fights and pay the most money that you possibly can. And if he can make the push to get Bilal on a win or Kamaru off the Buckley win into a fight with Islam, he's going to push for it. But maybe that's a conversation they've been having. But to me, I just have to assume that that is not a reality. So I have to give Bilal a zero, because it's like, if you're not going to fight him, and that holds true after you win, there's nothing to talk about. But if Ali's in the background working his magic, you know, maybe there's a conversation being had, and we'll have a different conversation.
Yeah. And that Bilal, let's say Bilal is gassing us up on that clip, and he has a game plan that's more in true to what Bilal has made Bilal Muhammad successful and a UFC champion. Currently, my bookie has Bilal Muhammad at plus 190 and Ian Machado Gary at minus 250. Does that seem right to you, or is the former champion not getting enough respect here?
It's always age, dude. It's always an age thing. I think it's always age. Bilal, he's closer to my age. He's 36, 37 years old, something like that. So I think it's an age thing. The young guy is always going to be favored in these types of situations, much like Buckley and Usman. Granted, Usman was coming in on a bit of a skid, but you know, for Bilal, I think the fight to make is him and Usman. I think that's like, if he can go out and beat Machado Gary, you know, and for Usman, maybe they want Usman to get one more high profile win. Both of these guys in the later stages of their career, there's a huge storyline. And I want to see this clip of Bilal slapping Usman. And I think the only way we're going to see it is that they're going to fight each other. So I think that if we're playing matchmaker, I think Usman versus the winner of Machado Gary, or if Bilal beats Machado Gary, I think it should be Usman and Bilal.
Yeah. What is your prediction? Do you think Bilal wins this fight, or is this Ian Gary's time?
I haven't deep dove on my analysis yet. I was going to save it for my 15-hour flight to Doha. But for now, I will say this. I think that it's going to go five rounds. I just don't see either of these guys being able to finish each other. Bilal has shown
it's actually three rounds.
Oh, it's three rounds? Oh, yeah. It's not the main event. I keep thinking it's a main event because it's such a big fight. I know. Yeah, it's a
five round. That does change things, too. A lot of us thought it was five rounds, and then we confirmed it as three.
Yeah. The best main co-main on a fight night that we've had in a long time. I mean, that's incredible. I think it goes 50, especially since it's 25 minutes. I think it goes 15 minutes, or especially since it's not a 25-minute fight. I think it definitely goes 15 minutes. Bilal in the past has shown that, you know, way in the past, he's susceptible to head kicks like we saw in the Jeff Neal fight. Machado Gary, you know, we saw, I think it was the Song Keenan fight, ate that big left hook, almost got knocked out. Carlos Prochus had him on the ropes with the ground and pounds. That's an area that Bilal really specializes in. My opinion could change, but right now off the top, I'm going to take the dog. I'm going to take Bilal Muhammad. I think that one thing about Bilal, maybe you don't see it in his fighting style, but from what I know behind the scenes, is there's a very thorough approach to the way that they prepare for these fights. They really, like, my coach was there training Pena for one of her fights with Nunes while Bilal was getting ready for Wonderboy. And the, you know, 90% of the people that fight Wonderboy, their trick to the game plan is like, we'll bring in Raymond Daniels and we'll formulate our game plan by working with Raymond Daniels. He did not do that. He had, you know, Ignacio Bahamundes, he had his guys, a lot of thorough game planning and attention to detail in their practices. They don't waste time on the mats. So I do believe Bilal is going to always, like always, except for the JDM fight, which still blows my mind. I think that he will come in here with a very disciplined game plan. No stone will be left unturned. The attention to detail will be on point. I think he'll get the job done.
Okay, let's close out before we talk about the Qatar main event quickly, because I know we're going long here.
Yeah.
What is the Ian Gary title shot case if he wins here? Of course, he has the one loss to Shavkat. he could be out of action. He's stepped up for the UFC multiple times on short notice, done them some favors. He's got, you know, a personality that is polarizing to a lot of people. I think he's turned people back in his side more so than he was a year or two ago, but and clearly a very talented guy and very confident and not hesitant to do all the outside the cage stuff and pretty damn skilled in the cage. Can you see a world where he fights Islam next with a win here?
I could, you know, but the thing is, he's going to have to take some chances. I think that there is a route for him to beat Bilal that's a little bit safer. And if he takes that route and wins, I don't think he'll be the next guy. I think that if he can go out there and put a stamp on this fight, which is going to be very hard, if he can go out there and get a big finish over Bilal Muhammad, which he's going to have to do by knockout, I mean, there is a reality where he could be the next guy. I mean, we saw, you know, when we had Conor at his peak and the Irish fans on his side and what that brought to the sport, it was a very 2016 was incredible. I mean, 2016 was one of the greatest years in the sport, in my opinion, one of the best, one of the best to be a part of, one of the best to be a fan of. 2016 was incredible. Maybe Ian Garry isn't as captivating and as polarizing as Conor was at that time, but a world where he wins this fight and gets into a title fight, the battle of the nations, the rivalry, what would come with it. Ian's good on the mic. He's got a sharp tongue. And he's a smart fighter and he's damn good. He's got skills and his ability to overcome adversity. And he is a guy that also has a lot of, he's a year round fighter. He's always in shape. He stepped up for the UFC on multiple occasions. He's as much as, you know, he's an anywhere, any place, anytime type of guy. He really is. He may not look like Cowboy Cerrone. He may not, you know, but he is that guy, just a cleaner cut version of it. So if he can go out there and knock out Bilal Muhammad, I would give Ian Garry, I would put him right there with Shavkat. I'd put him at an 8.5. I'd put him right there with him.
Either a 9 or an 8, you got to either got to put him above Shavkat or below.
I would put him at a 9. Put him at a 9 because he would have to win by knockout. But if he can go out and do it faster than Morales did against Brady, 10. But that's going to be hard.
Yeah. Fair. Okay. That concludes our rankings on this side of it. I'll quickly go through for anyone who missed it. Bilal Muhammad, a 0, but a 0 with circumstance around it. And then we got Carlos Prochas with a 5 out of 10, Kamaru Usman 6.5, Shavkat or Ilya Topuria 8, Shavkat Rakhmonov 8.5, and then Ian Garry 9 and Michael Morales 10. So yeah, let's see. We did an hour and a half just to conclude what I said in the minute matchmaker video post fight that it should be Michael Morales, but I thought it was well done, Mike. Your camera's glitching a little bit there. Do you have any idea what's going on there? Are you losing power or anything? Or
no, I think I'm good now.
Okay, cool. Right, well, we'll close it out quickly here. You are getting ready to board a very long flight to Qatar. Initial UFC event there. It's a great lineup. A lot of interesting fights, prospects making their debut. Oh yeah, before we skip through welterweight, they signed Yaroslav Apasov too. That's an exciting addition to this freaking weight class. I think he's 27-1 or something like that, former Bellator champion. So that guy's coming UFC debut against Neil Magny on December 13th. But alas, the UFC Qatar main event, we have Armin Sarukian, according to my bookie, at a -550 favorite. Ooh. Dan Hooker +370. We know Armin is very good. He was supposed to fight for the title at the beginning of the year. Is there a case, a world, where Dan Hooker pulls off a huge upset and changes the lightweight title mix here? And if so, how?
I mean, for Dan Hooker, I think it's going to really revolve around him having to use his knees. I just don't know if he's going to have the submission capabilities to submit Armon if Armon wants to go with a grappling approach to his game plan. But I think for Hooker, that is going to be his best weapon in this fight. He's the taller fighter. He's the rangier fighter. If he can poke at Armon Sarukian and keep him fighting at his range, if Hooker can keep him fighting at his own range and force Armon to take some bad shots, I mean, that's the best weapon for Dan Hooker in this fight is his knees. But I think Armon is just so skilled. I mean, Armon is so good everywhere. He can fight to his opponent's strengths in any facet, whether it's striking, grappling, jiu-jitsu. Like, he can play to their strengths and he can win. The only thing he has to avoid is at times, sometimes Armon's combinations can look almost predetermined. Like, it's almost like he's like, I'm going to throw like a jab, cross, hook, kick. And it's like, if you start throwing like programmed combinations like that, you can make a read on that. And Hooker is as good of a striker as anybody. So I think that as long as Armon doesn't throw these predetermined combinations at a predictable cadence, I think he could win this fight anywhere. So I think Armon Sarukian wins. And I think he's going to win handedly.
Yeah, I tend to agree. And it'll be interesting to see what happens here. We don't need to go into a whole lightweight title conversation.
Yeah,
I
because
thought it
I
was
just took
almost.
you through the weeds for an hour and a half.
No, I love it. I mean, not that we don't have the time. I just think it's almost like kind of in the air right now. It seemed like they wanted Ilya and Paddy for January. Seems like Ilya's timeline might have changed. I don't even know when he's going to fight again right now. So that's, we'll see what happens with all that. But you got a big flight to catch. I know when you were on here 2 months ago, you were kind of saying end of 2025, super busy for you with commentary and work and all other stuff. Are you starting to think about a timeline for a fight yet?
Yeah, I think towards the end of winter, maybe early spring, somewhere in there. That's kind of what it's looking like for me. But I'm excited, man. I'm excited to close out the year. I got Qatar, I got UFC BJJ 4, got CFFC on the 20th of December, and then a little bit of time off. So some time to be home, focus on training, spend some time in the mountains, and come up with a game plan as to what's next for me. So I will definitely compete in 2026.
Awesome. Yeah, there's some chit chat out there that maybe Toronto will get event sometime in that time frame. So maybe again on that one we do this in person, but we'll see what
There
happens.
we go. I
Start
like
after a
that.
while. All right, Mike, appreciate you so much. I'm gonna take a quick break and be right back to wrap things up. And that does it for another edition of the Bonfire Podcast. Thank you so much to Mike for his time. That was tremendous. Hope it's a safe flight over to Qatar for him. That is a journey, but you know this man loves the game. He says he's most excited to just have all that time in the air to study for his commentary shows, for UFC fights. This man loves the game, and you can tell his passion every time he comes on the show. As I said off the top, very bright future, I think, on the other side of the camera and not in the octagon, even though, as we heard, he ain't done as a fighter yet. Still more to come from him in 2026. So appreciate everyone tuning in. Appreciate his time. Appreciate the man, Kamikaze Abi Suban, for putting the show together. Want to thank everyone again for their support. Last weekend's episode with Dustin Poirier breaking down UFC 322, our biggest one to date. Channel's growing, everything's growing. Honestly, warms my heart. So let's keep it going. Like, rate, subscribe, comment, all those things. Show it to a friend. Do all that stuff to throw support our way, because it truly does mean a lot. So until next week, I will see you all back here by the bonfire.